As you've already heard, that needs going out the way, thank you. Last year I finished some research looking at suffering and hope. And what I had done was I interviewed Christians who'd, mostly those who'd visited the detention centres, but also people who'd supported refugees on the temporary visas, and used that to compare and contrast to what some of the major theologians had written on the topic of suffering and hope. I chose the two theologians that I did basically because they are the main theologians, and there were some similarities between the two and some differences. They were both older teenagers in Germany in the Second World War, and Moltmann was actually drafted into the army, and he tells the story of his father coming to meet him just before he was sent off to fight, and telling him of having his father had seen the trainloads of Jewish people being sent to the concentration camps, and kind of said to the young Moltmann, just be careful. You know, he didn't think there'd be any implications for the young Moltmann, but he thought there might be some for himself. And Zola, well, she was a bit younger. She was probably about 14, 15 towards the end of the war. But she was from a very socially aware family who would have obviously had quite a lot of difficulties with the Nazis. And with what I'm talking about today, Zola doesn't actually write much about hope. She writes more about why she doesn't write about hope than she writes about hope. So one of my chapters is actually exploring can we even talk about hope as, you know, fairly wealthy, you know, got everything Westerners. But that's not the one that I'm talking about today. But just to get ourselves started and warmed up, we've kind of started thinking about the first of these two points. But I'd really like you to think about where was God at this time. So think back about your time of difficulty, a time, you know, when maybe things weren't going so well. And perhaps I'll just have the second question, where was God? And I'll bring back some of those thoughts, what gave you hope and where was God at that time when you've just had a little time to talk. Okay, I know that's only been a very short time, and you might like to keep thinking about this during the week, but would anybody like to share their sense, some of their thoughts on the questions that we've had? It might be a bit personal, but... No? Okay. More time, I know. I know. I'm sure I could leave people all day just discussing this one question. And that was kind of the nutshell of, you know, in a lot of ways, these two questions is kind of the bulk of what my interview questions were. But of course, I fleshed them out a bit more. And one of the things that I've kind of noticed with the readings is that it seems like some of the liberals, not quite the right words, but some of the more liberal churches, a lot of the more liberal churches are almost afraid of talking about hope because it's been hijacked to that pie in the sky, hallelujah, brother sort of idea. That's got nothing to do with what we are doing here now in this earth, turning into, you know, in our process of turning into butterflies. But just to explain, a little anecdote to start with, which both explains the title of my thesis and also explains the use of the pictures. I put some pictures in my thesis, mainly just between the major sections, to kind of highlight, and I'm going to show them all to you, but to highlight what this is about. You know, they say a picture tells 1,000 words. Well, I've kind of already done a couple of thousand with just the pictures. But there's a little girl in Woomera. This picture is actually on the front page once you open up my thesis, and this story is very briefly there as well. One of the advocates told it to me. There was a little girl in Woomera, you know, in the middle of the desert, South Australia, miles of just about, well, nothing except for scrub, except for this detention centre, a mine, and not much else. And this, one of the advocates, who was a minister, went up regularly from Port Augusta and got a lot of grief from Port Augusta, or from a lot of the people around there. And he went up to visit the people in the Woomera Detention Centre. And this little child said to him, "Aren't there any flowers in Australia?" She had never seen a flower since she'd come to Australia because they just weren't where she was. And so this gentleman organised for people from all over Australia to send the flowers to Woomera. And on that day, the desert bloomed. And it's a wonderful symbol of hope. Just to go back to the slightly bigger picture, there's so much roughness and harshness in the ground, and yet somehow these beautiful desert peas find enough nutrients and find what they need to bloom and to make the desert beautiful. So this is actually a picture looking towards what's left of, or what was left of Baxter when I was over there doing my research interviews. You can see the Flinders Ranges in the background, which beautifully cut off any cool breeze in summer. You've got the Gulf, Spencer Gulf, if you can imagine that. And pretty much this bit of the mountain, this bit of the Flinders Ranges, is between the Gulf and the detention centre. So any breeze comes straight from the desert. It was usually 46 degrees plus, not much air conditioning, occasional fans. And Baxter was actually built, it was worse than Woomera, it was built so that you, in the compounds, in the places where the asylum seekers were, you couldn't see out. You could only see the sky. And I think somebody said there was one little crack between the buildings where they could actually see into the desert. And that would kind of be the place where people would gather just to peek between these buildings and look past the four walls that they were contained in. It was also, and this is a great one for traumatised war survivors, right next to where the army practised their shelling. As I won't go too much into the background because I'm sure quite a few people do know what that is, except to say that Australia is one of the few Western countries that has a UN torture finding against us, and that's what it's from. So hence, obviously, why this is the people who supported them are a really good group of people to reflect on suffering and hope. It was just too problematic to talk to the refugees themselves, and part of that was the risk of re-traumatising people. So the first section of my thesis looked at the question of suffering and how do we talk about God in suffering. This is actually out on the Nullarbor. You can't quite get it in this photo, but I had to get out of the car and look for the road. And that's what it was like for a lot of the people, even the people who were there as supporters, as advocates, rather than in the detention centres themselves. Especially in the country towns, there were people who 5 years later, 5 years after Baxter had closed, were still suffering from post-traumatic stress, not from being in the detention centres, but from visiting them. So there was a lot of suffering. And part of what I explore in my thesis is, how do we hold people in that suffering? You know, a lot of the Christian writing, or a lot of the writing on suffering and hope, tends to either focus on Good Friday as a metaphor for suffering, or Easter Sunday, and you know, it's all resurrection, hallelujah, and happy again. But what they, there was only one other author that I found who actually considered that the concept of, well, there was Easter Saturday between the two, the time of the waiting, the time when all that stress and anxiety is kind of over, and it's just, what now? What's, you know, there's nothing now sort of idea. So how do we hold people in that time of suffering when, you know, when that acute phase is past? This is, I think it's a Kwangdong tree, once again taken on the Nullarbor. But it's the little, you might be able to see in the photo, the little bits of fruit. The seeds for the next generation. Where is the hope? And that's what I'm going to focus on mostly today. In fact, just one aspect of it, which is about compassion. But the other comment to make about hope is, I mentioned earlier that Moltmann and Zola were both Germans in the Second World War. And one of the things that neither of them, or what they write a lot about, is what it means to be forgiven. Understandably, I can really understand that. And I can also understand that what they miss out on, and hence what all the other other major theologians miss out on, is writing about what does it mean to forgive. And there were some incredible stories of the refugees and asylum seekers finding ways of dealing with, forgiving what had happened. One actually sent a card to Amanda Vanstone to say, basically saying, I'm sorry that you just didn't get it, and I forgive you. Another mention was asked by somebody, what does it mean to forgiveness? And this was somebody who'd been badly tortured in Egypt. And he had said, it's about handing it over to God because I can't deal with it. And I thought that was a wonderful way of talking about forgiveness. And I think if a torture victim can say that, then it's something that I can aim to do, even if I can't succeed. And then the last section that I wrote about was, well, how do we talk about God in all of this? And what are some of the useful images? And that, once again, that's too big to go through here, but I guess I'm just giving you an overview. So if you want to find out more, ask me more, you know, it kind of gives you some more things to ask about. So this is a picture of, you know, water in the wilderness. Okay. And of course, as we've heard, at least on one day the desert has bloomed, and so I'll just leave that photo up as I talk about. We'll focus in now on compassion. So just to give you a little bit on Moltmann, because I think I'd be right guessing not many people have actually read his work. It's a bit of stuff to wade through, but anyway. But I won't talk too much because, of course, it's theoretically possible at least to read his work. He does write sparingly on compassion, but rather he focuses on the concept of love and how this motivates action. And he speaks of God's suffering because of compassion for Christ on the cross. That's kind of where he keeps compassion. But he does see that love and hope are inseparable concepts, and each of them feeds into the other. He suggests that the love in which we fully identify with ourselves, with this transient, vulnerable and mortal life, and the resurrection hope belong together and interpret each other. You can't have the one without the other. Hope looks for a better future for the beloved, but love means that this cannot be simply left as an otherworldly dream. It has to be made present in the here and now. It requires that you're changed because of the suffering of another person. And it leads to deliberate exposures to the wounds of disappointment, contradiction, sickness and death out of compassion. It also leads to walking alongside the suffering other, and through that, bearing some of the suffering on oneself. And he calls this suffering element of love part of its greatness. And instead of trying to tell you all what the advocate said about compassion, I'm going to give you two extended stories that, to me, really highlighted what they were on about. The first one is from a young woman who I'll call Virginia, and these are all, of course, pseudonyms. And she was a young woman, in the equivalent of our western suburbs, you know, going to uni, had a good life, nothing really majorly wrong in her life. But she did go and visit the Villawood Detention Centre. And she said, and I suppose that having come from relationships with people who were vulnerable and yet, you know, showed love, showed their own compassion, I can remember when stuff was happening in my personal life, which all seemed very trivial compared to the people in detention. And I remember I'd been in a relationship with a boyfriend and we had gone to Villawood together for about a year. So he was well known to the refugee friends and they were friends with him and very important to him as well. And it was something that we shared, although I'd visited before I'd started dating this person. And then we broke up. And I was devastated. And I remember going the next time I went to Villawood, Hassan was asking me about that and telling me, I understand how you feel. And he told me some stories that were like so much worse because it was in the context of, I loved a Christian Palestinian and the family threatened to kill us. And so it was so much worse. But it was like in a situation that I saw strength is not the same as strength. Someone who has no control over his situation other than how he reacts to it, and even that was pretty hard on a psychological level, could still be compassionate. And perhaps their compassion meant so much more than when someone relatively secure deigns to help you. And the next anecdote was from a minister who lived near one of the country centres and visited it. And when that centre was closed, she actually ended up not quite as close to the Baxter Centre and tried to drop in periodically to see the asylum seekers there. And she says, at one stage, when after the centre had closed and there was really awful, well, the people who had been sent to Baxter were deteriorating badly. There was a particular thing going on, and my friend Zoe said to me, Joan, we're going on a hunger strike. We will be in there. And her husband, who's the head of the hospital there, said, much to my surprise, well, I'll monitor you both. Anyway, we ended up not doing it because the situation was sort of resolved. And we knew that going on a hunger strike would not achieve any difference, except perhaps being an act of solidarity. At least they would know we were walking with them. But we didn't end up doing that. But I'll say something about the incident that was going on. I haven't actually got permission from the refugee who did this, but to me, it's the most moving action I've ever come across. In love and support, and very traumatic. People that we had known, who are in the Protestant congregation in detention, who are now in Baxter, horrible place. And this one particular fellow must have been in such despair. I think there were probably three people involved, but this one that I particularly knew, he sewed his lips up, which is absolutely abhorrent to most of us. But when you feel so helpless. And the other fellow, Mahmoud, he went into his room and this friend, an older man, an Iranian, had sewed his lips up and he was crying. And Mahmoud couldn't get him to stop crying. He still had family in Iran and he was very worried about them. And he couldn't get him to undo his lips, couldn't get him to stop crying. And Mahmoud didn't know. He was helpless in this situation. And the only thing he could do was to sew his lips up, to walk the walk with him. Now, that sounds horrible to me, but to me, I haven't actually heard of anything more moving, and to me, it's a huge act of love. But I think it's one of the biggest acts of love I know, and a situation that by most people is understood, but I do understand. And that last story actually still chokes me up when I hear it, having talked about it quite a lot. It's one that I have to go back to, because I don't think there's anything that can illustrate compassion like going and doing what Mahmoud did for his friend, even when it didn't actually have any practical outcomes other than you know, possibly he would have been thrown in solitary confinement as well because he'd done that, but what else can you do for a friend who's so hopeless? So reflecting on compassion. And we've seen that it's very important to the advocates and the asylum seekers in dealing with the great suffering of the detention centres. It was a central theme. And when I thought about compassion, it reminded me of the Hebrew origin for the word compassion, which is rachamim, and is derived from their word for the womb, and relates to the mother's physical and psychological bond with her child. In contrast, love, which Moltmann talks about, in Christian thought has been defined as an affective disposition towards another person arising from qualities perceived as attraction or natural relationship or from sympathy. But you might be aware, and as one author notes, concepts of compassion have been misinterpreted through Christian history. And for some, it now has an implication of piousness or even romanticising the crucifixion. The advocates saw compassion as a core value of Christianity and as central to the biblical text. One advocate expressed concern at forms of Christianity which do not have compassion for other people. She said about a couple that she knew, "They had obviously taken on board fundamentalism, and that's a killer as far as I'm concerned because it doesn't have the compassion that Christianity ought to have." This concern regarding a form of Christianity lacking compassion is supported by the biblical text, where issues of compassion are deeply rooted within it. From the earliest stories of the Old Testament, it is God's compassion for the suffering people which leads to the action shown in the Exodus story, such as in Exodus 3, 7 and 8. In rescue from oppression, both during the Philistine invasions and during the exile. However, it's in the Psalms and the prophets that the image of God as compassionate is particularly noticed. And we heard in today's Old Testament reading, Isaiah saying, or likening God's compassion to a mother, and Isaiah says, "Can a woman forget her nursing child or show no compassion for the child of her womb? Even if these forget, yet I will never forget you." The compassionate God is not only an image found in the Old Testament, but is also integral to the expression of Jesus' ministry as found in the New Testament gospel stories. And it was to these stories of Jesus showing compassion for the poor to which advocates turned in their descriptions of what compassion meant for them. The prevalence of compassion in the gospel stories is illustrated by one advocate who, in reflecting on hope, said, "It's the hope that Jesus gives to individuals in the different healing stories before they were included in their community and restored. So the woman who bled for 12 years, the Samaritan woman at the well, all of these stories, Bartimaeus, it's all the nobodies who were given roles and are shown to have faith and shown to be valued and worthwhile." Thus, the advocates saw acts of compassion as being central to the ministry of Jesus and hence to their perception of Christian life. Yet, if compassion is so central to Christianity as has been argued, the question must be raised as to why there has been so little written on it, on a theology of compassion and the hope that it generates. The connection between compassion and hope becomes important in this context of asylum seekers. Like hope, compassion is somewhat helpless, although it can motivate action. As with the asylum seeker who sewed his lips together in an act for compassion for a friend who had lost all hope, so the symbolic actions of compassion can generate the hope that one is not alone. Even when there is no action that will make a practical difference, the standing alongside another person in compassion has made a difference in the lives of the asylum seekers and refugees. If a framework for a theology of compassion is to be developed and connected to hope, then the reflections of the advocates give insight into some important aspects which need to be included. Compassion is more than a romanticising of pain or even a pious attitude. It does not minimise pain or say, I know how you feel, as an intellectual exercise. Rather, compassion is about the genuine engagement with the pain of the other, as the original Latin word implies, with passion. It also has to be differentiated from sympathy, which is feelings of pity and sorry for someone else's misfortune. Drawing on the Hebrew connection between compassion and the womb, it could be suggested that compassion involves an emotional bond that goes far beyond the intellectual understanding that is involved with other things like empathy. Compassion means a feeling with the other, in perhaps the most literal sense of both the Hebrew and the Latin words. Yet compassion is more than just feeling with. It also affects the suffering person. Through relating to the other person, compassion involves holding up a mirror which looks towards a different future. Compassion is not only seeing the hurt and wounded person in a situation of pain, but also seeing the potential of that person and reflecting that back together with what the future could hold. Like love, compassion also calls for a response to the person and the situation. Perhaps then, the link with hope and compassion is the removal of the isolation of the experiences of suffering. It is by connecting the feelings of isolation and aloneness that relationships can be established and hope generated through the relationship. Zola, the other author, expresses this in terms of solidarity. She says, Christ is a name for which for me expresses solidarity, hence suffering with, struggling with. Christ is the mysterious power which was in Jesus and which continues on and sometimes makes us into fools for Christ, who, without hope of success and without an objective, shared life with others. Solidarity is not just standing alongside another. In many ways, it is an act of companionship which implies relating to the other and not seeing them simply as an object of pity. A Christian theology of compassion, therefore, aims to affirms the need for solidarity. When no action can be taken, it means engaging in the helplessness of the suffering ones. And where change can be made, in doing that, but not at the expense of the relationship. A theology of compassion is therefore an essential part of responding to the injustice of the world and needs to be developed more fully than has occurred to date. Compassion brings hope to those who are suffering through connections and relationships that are developed and the reducing the isolation of the suffering. And I'd like to finish with a poem that I wrote. I actually wrote poetry through this as a way of processing all these stories that I was hearing. And this particular poem, I always call the real conclusion to the thesis. You know, the other one's just the official one that the markers needed to see. So this is, what is hope? Imagine a rubbish tip. The sort that you see on TV in an impoverished country. With kids picking their way across the mounds that smoke with poisonous air. Burning its way into the polluted atmosphere. In the sort of documentary that makes the stomach turn just imagining the smell, or leads the more kindly among us to condescendingly reflect, there but for the grace of God go I. Naked kids in poverty, scratching out a living from the throwaway lives of the rich, hunting down scraps of food or scraps of anything that can be sold. Imagine the smell, the toxins, the infected sores on scratched knees, the poverty, the grind. This is not hope. Now, imagine in a polluted corner of the tip, a small and insignificant flower, almost hidden by the piles of rubbish, struggling to survive, struggling to bloom, a tiny blossom. This is hope. Would anyone like to ask any questions or share any reflections? Or it's over to you, I guess. I would say at least it would be very difficult. Yes. Yes.
What are the questions you ask to check how close someone is doing?
Yes. And you know, as you might know, there was a lot of attempted suicide, a lot of self-harm in the detention centres. But every so often there would be something like that story that I mentioned earlier, where somebody would carry that hope, even if it was a phone call from a friend outside. One of the other stories I was going to share with you was with a woman who phoned this detainee on a hunger strike every day that he was on the hunger strike, and that's what took him from saying he was basically got hunger striking because it was the only way he could kill himself, to living, married, and having a life and having a future now. And it was the sense of somebody holding that hope. Even if he didn't have it, there was somebody who would hold that for him.
Did the advocate say anything about how they went and replenished themselves after they visited? Because there is a condition for compassion.
Yes, or secondary post-traumatic stress, yes. They didn't actually talk, not that I actually asked them about it. I mean, I did ask, you know, about, you know, how they still had hope and that sort of thing. But I do know that I actually stayed with the Sisters of Mercy up in Port Augusta, and they were fantastic. The advocates who came up from the city, it was actually quite different, Adelaide, Sydney compared to Perth, because, of course, the detention centre we had here was up in Port Hedland, so people from Perth didn't go up and visit. So they weren't really connected in the same way. Or if they did, it was, you know, every 3-4 months rather than every month from people from Adelaide, or every week people from the local towns. People in Adelaide and Sydney had a lot of support. There were large support networks that helped people deal with it. And as far as I noticed, there was a few people who got a bit teary when they were talking to me about it. One person actually had stopped the interview, have a break in the interview. But as a general rule of thumb, the people in the city were they'd had that support and they'd been able to deal with it. And so it was really just when it touched those really, really touching stories, or people who they got to know particularly well. Whereas when I went to Port Augusta and Whyalla, and obviously people were visiting much more frequently, Port Augusta was about 15 minutes from Baxter, Whyalla was about an hour, so people would go every week to visit Baxter. Plus, you know, there was a reasonable sized element in the town who did not want the asylum seekers there, and so that automatically put a lot of pressure on. That was also where the guards for the detention centres were living, so there was a lot of sympathy for the guards from people, etc. And plus there weren't the support services. So the Sisters of Mercy, who I stayed with, were fantastic, and they obviously had their wider support network, and so they ran retreats for people in the town and helped them. But having said that, that's where I found most of the people who really still hadn't dealt with it. You know, I spoke to them 5 years later. There was one woman who, you know, still suffered from that secondary trauma because of what she'd been through. And another woman who I highly suspect did, and I suspect she hadn't ever had that chance to process it, because it was like walking into this wall of words. I think I was the first person who she really had the chance to talk to about it. And 3 hours later, I hadn't even got to the end of my first question because she needed to talk and talk about whatever. And it really wasn't actually a research interview. It was more therapy session in the end for her. So, you know, and that was all she really had to cope with to deal with what she'd had. That's where it was a lot more of the difficulties, was because of the lack of support there.
I was going to say, so from your experience of talking and speaking with Danny, what was worse, life in our homeland or being locked up in detention?
I didn't actually speak to the asylum seekers themselves, but I do have friends who are asylum seekers, and that was the one thing that kept them through, was that if they went back to their homeland, they knew they were going to die. If they stayed here, then maybe they'd have the chance of life. So a lot of, from their accounts, and this is obviously not a systematic review, it's, you know, from the accounts of my friends, a lot of the people who signed to go back were the people who were just so despairing they were ready to die. And so they may as well die at home where maybe they've got their family and friends, and they are on their home soil. Most of the people, as far as I know, didn't ever want to leave their home country. And they wouldn't have if they had half the chance of not doing it. Sorry? Yeah.
And that's vital. Could you get a sense that
sorry?
In my organisation or the
yes. 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 That's kind of some of the stuff that I deal with in the background of my thesis. It wasn't, and it's well documented, which is why, and it wasn't what I was looking at in the terms of suffering and hope. But yes, there is, there was and there still is. So the first refugees to be released on the temporary visas actually came to Perth, and were pretty much dumped in a rather expensive hostel on the equivalent of Newstart. And there was a little article in the West Australian about them, and a couple of people from some of the local churches decided that they'll go and, you know, have a chat to them and see if they could teach some English. And when they got there, they realised just how great the need was for people being released on detention. They didn't have... Basically, if you had a temporary protection visa, you had the same as any other temporary visa. So, except that you got a living allowance paid, which was the equivalent of Newstart. If you had a bit of a work history, Newstart's okay. If you've got nothing, you've just come out of detention, you've fled for your life, come out of detention, Newstart isn't enough. So they had no housing support. They couldn't get Homes West. They couldn't access government. Their children theoretically had a right to go to school, but they had to pay full fees. And when I say full fees, I'm not talking about private school fees. I'm talking about private school fees minus having the government subsidise them. So the Catholic schools are fantastic, and they slip the kids into the Catholic schools around the place, and if they knew a government inspector was coming around, they'd just take those kids out for a walk for the day. Jeff Gallop was great because the asylum seekers, or the refugees here, weren't allowed to officially enrol in the TAFE English classes, so he said, just come and sit in the classes, we won't tell anybody. So there was a lot of that going on an organisational scale. There are organised, like CARID, which the little group that went to teach English turned into CARID, which is still quite a large organisation. And they had people who gave, who helped, you know, find rental accommodation. They had other people who had, you know, rental houses that they said, well, just go in and, you know, have cheap rent, and some of those people actually put the rent aside so that when, you know, the people were ready to move on, they got something for their bond and something to pay. They had a warehouse that people would donate to and help furnish these houses for, you know, people who've got nothing. So yes, there was a lot of that organised. There's volunteer English classes. There's still a organisation in Perth called Case for Refugees, and similar organisations over east. Case for Refugees does the legal and migration stuff. So that's a couple of lawyers working virtually pro bono a couple of days a week. So, you know, they get their office there, and volunteers taking the stories, especially when there's, you know, say, issues of torture and trauma. I actually, before I did this, did some just an afternoon's volunteer for work for CASE, looking at their op health and safety, because that's my other background. So they would actually have volunteers in there for 4 or 5 hours listening to these trauma stories, which at that stage was, you know, a lot of what they were doing, applying for the permanent protection visas. Although it wasn't my brief, it's what I was doing for them, I was actually suggesting that they look at, you know, how they support those volunteers, because that's a long time to hear torture and trauma. And you're about to wind me up, aren't you? Okay, oh, well, I will be around. Love to talk about it. If you get me started, I won't finish. If you've got any other questions, drop me an email. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been really lovely to share some of these stories and to share some of my reflections with you.
I'm just going to finish with two songs.